he angling for new permission to go on a raid. He must know that a Hauptmann cannot overturn the orders of a major. For that matter, Hans could not imagine when Addy had asked Eckert's approval for such an action. They had been together nearly all day. Perhaps when Hans had gone to the latrines for his morning turnout. It was very odd. "If I had a crack at it," said Addy wistfully, "do you think Eckert would overlook the insubordination? I just love to." "You can't disobey a direct order," said Rudy. "Leave it with Papa. I'll think of something." Mendt was tasting his first foul mug of ersatz coffee the next morning when Ernst Schmidt approached in a state of uncharacteristic excitement.
"Hans, have you heard? Oh, God, it's too terrible!"
"Heard what? I've only just got up, for Christ's sake!"
"Look, then, take a look!"
With shaking hands, Ernst thrust a pair of field glasses under the other's nose. Hans took up his helmet and went grumbling forward to the nearest trench ladder, easing his head slowly above the parapet line. The usually taciturn Ernst Schmidt must be losing control, he thought to himself.
3 o'clock, to the left of the flooded shell hole. There!
Get down, you fool! Do you want to get us both shot? There, can you see?
Oh, God, the ruin of it!
Suddenly, Hans saw. Gloder lay face up, his sightless eyes staring at the risen sun, his ivory throat open, and scarlet pools of jellied blood spread down his tunic like frozen lakes of lava. A meter or so beyond his outflung fist, Colonel Maximilian Balligan's grand ceremonial lobster-tailed Pickelhauber stood, spike upwards, as if the colonel himself, buried underground, were wearing it still. Over one shoulder, in casual hussar style, hung the richly braided mess jacket of a French brigadier. A movement in the foreground caught Hans's attention. Slowly, centimetre by centimetre, from the direction of the German lines, a man was crawling on his stomach towards the body.
"My God!" whispered Hans. "It's Addy! Where?"
Hans passed the field glasses over to Ernst.
"Damn it! If we start up any covering fire, the French will spot him for sure. Get down!
We'll use periscopes. It's safer." For 20 minutes, they watched in silent prayer as Addy wormed his way towards the wire.
"Careful, Addy," Hans breathed to himself. "Zoll für Zoll, mein Kamerad."
Addy edged his way along the main roll of wire between himself and Rudy until he came to a section marked with tiny fragments of cloth, a coded doorway left by the wiring parties. This entrance safely negotiated, he resumed his belly-down journey to the body. Once he had got there...
"What now?"
said Ernst.
"Smoke," said Hans.
"Now he's there, we can put up smoke between him and the enemy forward trenches. Quick!" Ernst bellowed for smoke pistols while Hans continued to watch. Addy, lying face down, seemed to be blindly feeling the wound in Rudy's back.
"What's he doing? I don't know. Perhaps Rudy isn't dead."
"Of course he's dead. Didn't you see his eyes?"
"Then what's Addy doing?"
Hans couldn't see, for his view of body was obscured by Addy, rising on all fours.
"Jesus, get down, you maniac!"
Hans whispered. As if he had heard, Addy suddenly dropped flat again and lay motionless beside Gloder's corpse.
"My God, has he been hit?"
"We would have heard."
"He's frozen up, then."
Hans became aware of a gathering commotion in his own trench. He pulled back from the periscope and looked about him. Ernst's alarm had alerted dozens of men. No, not men. Boys, most of them. A few had periscopes themselves and were relaying in fatuous commentary every detail of the scene. The others turned their big, frightened eyes on Hans.
"Why isn't he moving? He's frozen. Has he lost his nerve?"
The sight of a man freezing up in no man's land was a common one. 1 minute you were running and dodging, the next you were stiff as a statue.
"Not Addy," said Hans as cheerfully as he could. "He's recovering his strength for the homeward run, that's all."
He turned back to the periscope. Still no movement.
"Everyone with a smoke pistol, get ready," he called.
Half a dozen men crept to the top of ladders, their pistols cocked back over their shoulders, cowboy fashion. Hans wetted his finger and checked the wind before setting back to watch. Suddenly, with no warning, Addy was up, facing the enemy. He hooked his arms under Rudy's and pulled him backwards towards the German lines, hopping backwards with bent knees like a Cossack dancer.
"Now!" shouted Hans. "Fire! Fire high and 5 minutes to the left!"
The smoke pistols clapped a polite round of applause. Hans watched Addy as the bombs fell beyond him, and a dense curtain of smoke rose and thickened, drifting gently in the wind between him and the French forward trenches. Addy lurched on towards the home lines without a pause or backward glance. Perhaps he'd been relying on the smoke screen, Hans thought. He trusted that we would know what to do. Perhaps he would have risked it anyway. Hans always knew Addy had the courage, but he would never have credited him with such brute strength.
"What the hell is going on here?"
Major Eckert had stamped into the trench, moustache quivering.
"Who gave orders to send up smoke?"
A young Franconian saluted smartly.
"It's Gefreiter Hitler, sir."
"Hitler? Who authorised him to issue such an order?"
"No, sir. He didn't order it, sir. He's out there, sir, in Niemandsland, recovering Hauptmann Gloder's body, sir."
"Gloder? Hauptmann Gloder dead? How? What?"
"He went out last night to rescue Colonel Balligan's helmet."
"Colonel Balligan's helmet? Are you drunk, man?"
"No, Herr Major. The French must have taken it during Thursday's raid up the line, sir. Hauptmann Gloder went to rescue it." "He did too, and what's more, he pinched a brigadier's mess jacket as well. But then a sniper must have got him, sir."
"Good heavens!"
"Sir, yes, sir, and Gefreiter Hitler is out rescuing the body now, sir. Stubbs Gefreiter Ment ordered us to protect him with smoke."
"Is this true, Ment?"
Ment stood to attention.
"Quite true, sir. I believed it to be the best course."
"But damn it, the French might be led into the belief that we are attacking!"
Ment was too dazed and horrified to think clearly, but he managed to reply,
"Respectfully, Herr Major, that can do little harm. All that will happen is that Franzmann will waste a few thousand valuable rounds."
"Well, it's all very irregular."
"Not as irregular as you, you shithead schoolmaster," thought Ment, before giving himself up to more miserable considerations.
"And where's Hitler now?"
Schmidt bellowed the answer from behind his field glasses.
"He's at the wire, sir! Sir, he's all right, sir! He's found the doorway, he's got the body and the helmet, sir! He's even got the helmet!"
A great roar of delight went up from the men, and even Major Eckert allowed himself a smile. Hans, in his puzzled dismay, repeated and repeated to himself, "Eckert knew nothing about it until just now. Eckert knew nothing." Addy never told Eckert about the colonel's helmet yesterday. Addy never asked him permission to go on a raid. Yet he told me and Rudy that he had. Why had Addy lied? Hans walked slowly out of the trench, just as Rudy's corpse rolled into it. Addy followed, the colonel's helmet raised aloft in his right hand, the gold eagle stamped upon it, flashing in the sun. As Hans moved away, the cheering of the men grew and swelled inside him until it burst from his eyes in a flood of hot, disgusted tears.
Making Amends. Axel Bauer's story. Leo wiped the tears from his cheeks with the back of his hand. I sat quietly in the armchair, plucking horsehair and watching him nervously. I had never seen a grown man cry before. Outside a movie, that is. In movies, grown men cry all the time. But silently. Leo was crying with noisy sobs and great gulping catches of breath. I waited for this horrible tempest to blow itself out. After 2 or 3 minutes, he had taken off his spectacles and was polishing them with the fat of his tie. He blinked his wet red eyes across at me.
Oh, I know. Why did I not tell you before? Why did I let you believe that I was a Jew?
I made a sound, somewhere between a grunt and a whine, intended to convey assent, open-mindedness, understanding, I don't know, something like that. But the way the noise emerged, I seemed to be suggesting that the ball was with Leo, that it was up to him to do the talking, that I was reserving judgment. He must have taken it that way too.
You must know that this is not something you talk about so easily. Indeed, it is something I have never talked about before, except to myself.
I cast around for a constructive observation. Zuckerman, I said, it is a Jewish name, isn't it? There's a conductor, musician, something like that.
Pinchas Zuckerman. He is a violinist and a conductor, viola player too. Every time I see his name on a record in a newspaper, I wonder.
Leo replaced his glasses and sank down into the armchair opposite me. We sat facing each other as on the day we met. No coffee or hot chocolate this time, just the space between us.
My father's real name was Bauer, said Leo, Dietrich Josef Bauer. He was born in Hanover, July 1904. Throughout the 1920s, he trained in history and radiology and took a research post at the Anatomical Institute at the University of Münster under Professor Johannes Paul Kramer, about whom you shall hear more. My father joined the National Socialist German Workers' Party in 1932 and was for 2 years Sturmarzt in No. 8 SS Reiterstandart.
Sturmarzt?
Doctor. Almost everything in the SS begins with the word Sturm. What else do you need to know about them other than that they called their physicians Sturm doctors? Sturm doctors!
New tears were springing up in his eyes, and he shook his head back and forth.
Nature cries out!
For the first time in my life, I really wished that I smoked. I noticed that my left leg was bouncing up and down uncontrollably on the ball of its foot, a habit I thought it had abandoned since I was a screwed-up 16-year-old.
Be that as it may, said Leo, removing his glasses and wiping his eyes once more. In 1941, my father was enlisted to the Reserve Waffen SS with the rank of SS Hauptscharfführer, a kind of senior sergeant, like a sergeant major, I suppose, but without the duties of drill and so forth, a courtesy rank. This much I found out from my own research.
You didn't know him then, your father?
We come to that. In September 1942, he was practicing at the SS hospital in Prague and received a message from his old teacher, Professor Kramer, who had first encouraged him into the SS and had since been promoted to the junior officer rank of Untersturmführer, working on temporary assignment in a small town in Poland no one had ever heard of, a town called Auschwitz. Kramer wanted to return to his post in academia and recommended my father as a suitable replacement. I was 4 years old. My mother and I were living still in Münster. My Christian name was Axel. I have no memory of that time. We were summoned to join Papa in Poland in October 1942, and there we remained for 2.5 years.
Actually inside Auschwitz?
Good God, no! In the town, yes, the town. Always the town.
I nodded.
You ask if I remember my father. I tell you what I remember now, memories that have come back to me after years of absence. This happens as one ages, as doubtless you know. I remember now a man who was forever injecting me for diphtheria, typhus, cholera. Auschwitz town had many outbreaks of fever, and he was determined that I should not succumb. I remember too a man who would come home in the evenings with packages, bottles of Croatian plum wine, whole freshly killed rabbits and partridges, cakes of perfumed soap, jars of ground coffee, and for me coloured paper and crayons. These were all supreme luxuries, you must understand. Once he even brought home a pineapple. A pineapple! He never spoke of his work, except to say that he never spoke of his work. That is why I use the word work. It was his word. He was kind and funny, and at the time I believe I loved him with my whole heart. And what exactly, what was his work? His job was to treat the sick amongst the officers and men of the SS and to attend the Sonderaktionen as a medical observer. Sonder, special actions. The actions for which the death camps were built. The gassings. They called them special actions. Also, Leo paused and looked beyond me towards the window for a moment. Also, my father continued some medical experiments that had been initiated by Kramer, the removal of live organs for study. The two of them were interested in the rates of cellular atrophy amongst the malnourished and the physically weak, particularly where this affected the young. Kramer wrote to my father from Münster in 1943, asking him to carry on with the work and to send him the data regularly. I watched as Leo rose and went to the bookshelf. He took down a small black-and-white book and rifled through the pages. Kramer kept a diary, you know. It was his downfall. He was at Auschwitz for 3 months only, but it was enough. The diary was confiscated by the British, who allowed him to be extradited to Poland. Extracts are included in this book, which was published in Germany in 1988. I read to you. 10th October 1942. Extracted and fixed fresh live material from liver, spleen and pancreas. Got prisoners to make me a signature stamp. For first time heated the room. More cases of typhus fever and typhus abdominalis. Camp quarantine continues. Next day. Today, Sunday, there was roast hare for lunch, a real fat leg with dumplings and red cabbage. 17th October, attended trial and 11 executions. Extracted fresh live material from liver, spleen and pancreas after injection of pilocarpine. Attended 11th Sonderaktion in cold, wet weather this morning, Sunday. Horrible scenes with three naked women who begged us for their lives. And so on, and so on, and so on. This was Kramer's 3 months, his entire contribution to the final solution of the Jewish problem in Europe. My father's life there must have been very similar, but he kept no diary. No diary and no letters remain from his 2.5 years. Leo placed a pause between each word, 2.5 years. I swallowed. And was your father also captured at the end of the war? Always my mind goes back, I can't think why, said Leo, ignoring me entirely, to that one entry of Kramer's. Got prisoners to make me a signature stamp. Why is it, when one contemplates history, that one never considers things like this? You picture the gas chambers, the ovens, the dogs, the brutality of the guards, the disease, the terror of the children, the anguish of the mothers, the imponderable cruelty, the horror that cannot be described. But got prisoners to make me a signature stamp. A brilliant professor, head of an anatomy school, finds himself assigned to a concentration camp. After a week or so, he gets tired of signing endless orders. Orders to do what, do we suppose? Orders for new supplies of phenol and aspirin. Orders to have these or those sick prisoners declared unfit for work and processed for special action. Orders to authorize the extraction of live organs. Who knows? Just orders. So, damn it, he says one morning to a colleague. I can't persuade the quartermaster to issue me with a signature stamp. He tells me that I am only a temporary and that it will take 2 months for a stamp to come through from Berlin. What's the big deal, says his friend. Get the prisoners to make you one. And how does he proceed, this brilliant professor with 2 PhDs, who has sent 2 generations of trained healers and surgeons into the world? How does he go about putting this simple, obvious idea into action? Does he send for a prisoner, a Jewish capo, perhaps, and tell him to sort it out for him? Does he walk one day into a hut and say, as the prisoners stand to attention, "Look here, do any of you have skills in stationery? I need someone to make me a signature stamp. Volunteers, please." Who knows? Somehow, whatever the procedure, it is conveniently arranged. Kramer signs his name, Johannes Paul Kramer, on a piece of paper, and gives it to the chosen prisoner. What is the process, do we suppose? While the ink is still wet, the prisoner presses an uncut rubber stamp to the paper. The mirror image of the signature is transferred onto the stamp. The prisoner carefully cuts away the rest of the rubber. Does this maybe in an office, in a workshop, some place where he is allowed access to knives? Maybe it takes him an hour, maybe longer, to be sure of doing a good job and pleasing Herr Professor Obersturmführer Kramer, who is a man worth pleasing. So now Professor Kramer is the proud owner of a stamp bearing the perfect simulacrum of his signature, the 20th century equivalent of a signet ring or great seal. He no longer has the arduous task of having to sign his own name to pieces of paper. All he has to do is stamp. Bang! Bang! Leo thumped the side of his right fist into the open palm of his left hand with a violence and volume that shocked me upright. And what of the prisoner who made the stamp? Will one day his name be above the signature he so carefully cut out? Bang! Bang! And what of my father? When he arrived, did he too have a signature stamp made for him by a prisoner? Or did he wait for Berlin to supply him with something more official, something a little classier? Bang! Bang! He paused for breath. Here, I make myself some chocolate. Coffee for you. Maybe some cookies to nibble. I nodded dumbly. How sick to talk of chocolate and coffee and cookies after such a conversation, you are thinking, Leo said when he had returned from setting the kettle. You are right. The same disgusted thought strikes when one reads the writings of the men who ran the camps. Pathetic attempt at a rebellion in the shower rooms this morning. 12 or so naked Muslims. They called Jewish women Muslims. Did you know that? 12 or so naked Muslims tried to escape. Kretschmer shot each one in the leg and made them hop up and down for 10 minutes before liquidating them. The most comical sight. Wonderful beer for lunch, sent up from Bohemia. Excellent veal and real ground coffee to follow. Weather still abominable. That kind of thing you read again and again and again. Or the letters home. Darling Trudy, my God, this is a dreadful place. The steadfastness of the men in their work is frankly heroic. More Jews arrive every day, always so much to be done. You would be proud if you could see how little complaint the guards and officers make as they go about their tasks in the camp. With so much to provoke them from the ape-men Jews and their stink, give Mutti a kiss for me and tell Erich I want to hear a better report from school. This is the way of it. The banality of evil, I murmured. Leo frowned. Perhaps. I am never sure about this phrase. Ah, I hear the kettle. Outside the window, a lawnmower started up. A telephone was ringing unanswered in the room below. With the same rather feminine care as before, Leo set down the tray on the low table between us and poured out a coffee for me. So, one day in 1945, my mother calls me to her. Papa is standing beside her in his uniform, the black uniform of, by this time, an SS Sturmbannführer, the uniform that even today provokes terror in millions and sick admiration and lust in an insane few, the shaped black cap that bears the death's head along its band, the collar flashes that spell out SS in lightning strikes. This alone, such a masterstroke of design. What they would call today a logo, no? The puffed-out jodhpurs, the shining boots, the hunting crop to strike manfully against the thigh, the cuffs, the tie, the crisp shirt. The genius of the Nazis. Such a uniform has the power to turn the most laughable oaf into a towering Übermensch. Even the names of the rank carry this power of totem, Sturmbannführer. Straighten the peak of your cap in front of a mirror, raise your right hand in salute, click your heels together and say, Ich bin Sturmbannführer, Heil Hitler! Young children do it in play all over the world. The uniform, the language, the style. To the sane world, they are the symbol of all that is strutting, arrogant, cruel, barbarian, and bestial. All the things that shame us. To me, they are the symbol of all that is Papa. But that's not your fault. Michael, we will come to blame later, if you please. I raised a hand in apology. Hey, this was his game, his ball, his rules. So, my mother calls to me this one day, and I come. Papa kneels down in front of me and smooths back my hair, as he does when he wants to feel my brow for fever. Axi, he says to me, you are going to have to look after Mutti for a while. Do you think you can do that for me? I do not understand, but I look across at my mother, who is in tears, and I nod my head. My father, still on his haunches, turns to his medical bag. That's my soldier. First, I must do something that will hurt a little, for your own good. You understand? I nod my head again. I am used to injections. But this injection hurts more than any other I have had. It takes a long time to perform, and I am screaming in pain. Such pain bewilders and upsets me. But Mutti is there, stroking my hair and shushing me. A part of me understands that this is done in love. At last, Papa gives me a kiss, and then he stands and kisses Mutti. He pulls down sharply on his tunic to straighten the creases, gathers his medical bag and leaves the house. This is the last time I see him. Leo paused to blow across the surface of his chocolate before taking a careful sip. So, how old were you by this time? I was 6 years old. All that I am telling you is what I know, not necessarily what I remember. Some things I do recall very clearly. Most I do not. Little flashes, little islands of memory I have. I do not remember my mother explaining to me that we were to have a new name. I do not remember that I was once Axel Bauer. I cannot recall that my name was ever anything other than Leo Zuckerman. I know it, but I do not remember it. So how did you find all this out? In 1967 in America, I am at Columbia University, New York City, doing well. A young professor, not so much older than you are now, with a big future ahead of him. A Jewish boy, a survivor of the Shoah, teaching at an Ivy League school. If this is not a perfect example of the escape from the European nightmare into the American dream, then there never was one. But I am called one day on the telephone and summoned into the nightmare once more. This time I will never leave. Your mother has collapsed. Come at once, Leo. I drive like crazy over the bridge to Queens. When I arrive at my mother's apartment, I find hushed men and women gathered outside the room. A rabbi, a doctor, weeping friends. The old woman has been found on the kitchen floor. She's dying, the doctor says. I enter the bedroom alone. My mother signs for me to shut the door and come sit by her bed. She's weak, but she finds enough strength to tell her story. My story. She tells me what I have told you, that my real name is Axel Bauer, that my father was an SS doctor at Auschwitz. She tells me that by the end of 1944, my father knew for sure that the Russians were on their way, knew for sure that there would be a reckoning, a retribution for what had been done. He was convinced that vengeance would be taken not just on him, but on his whole family. The Jewish people, my father believed, whose motto is an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, would not be satisfied with his own death. Of this he was sure. Most methodically, he prepared a plan for the survival of his family. There was at the time a Jewish prisoner assisting in the surgery, a very brilliant doctor, originally from Krakow, by name of Abel Zuckerman. Zuckerman's wife, Hannah, a German Jewess from Berlin, and their young son, Leo, had naturally been gassed at once, for they were useless. But Zuckerman's knowledge of hepatic diseases was deemed of some service, and he was given work to do in the surgery. My father, it seems, was kind to Zuckerman, and secretly he gave him small amounts of food and encouraged him to talk about himself. Over the few weeks, my father learned a great deal about Zuckerman's family, his history, his estranged brother in New York, his education, his background, how he met his wife, everything there was to know. But a day came. This was the day the authorities decided that the Jew doctor had outlived his usefulness and that it was his Jew turn to join his Jew family in Jew hell. Maybe my father had a hand in that decision. It is something I ask myself with fear. But whether my father sent him to his death or not, this was the day Abel Zuckerman died. This was the day Sturmbannführer Bauer was able to put into operation his plan for the safety of his wife and son. This was the day he came to the house and told me to be strong and to look after my mother like a good soldier. This was the day he knelt down and tattooed my arm with a camp number, the best passport a child could have in the days that were coming. This was the day I became Leo Zuckerman. This was the day my mother, not Martha Bauer anymore, but Hannah Zuckerman, took me from Auschwitz and travelled west, always away from the Russians, whom my mother feared above all else. We would try to make sure we were picked up by the Americans or the British. Papa had promised my mother he would join us one day when it was safe. He would find us somehow, and we would be a family once more. In fact, my mother believed, he always knew that he could never see us again. All this I listened to while the rabbi and the friends wait outside. As my mother speaks, memories stir themselves awake and call to me like distant music. The memory of the pain from the tattoo needle, the memory of a pineapple, the memory of my father's uniform, and then the memory of walking at night, walking for miles at night and crying. The memory of being denied food. The memory of my mother saying to me over and over, "You must be thin, Leo. You must be thin." I tell her of this memory and ask if it means anything. "Poor boy," she says, "it tore at my heart to starve you, but how could I have persuaded an official that we were refugees from a concentration camp if we looked plump and well-fed?" After a week of walking south and west, she told me, we joined up with some Jewish refugees who had escaped from one of the death marches. Leo broke off here and looked at me inquiringly. "You know about the death marches?"
Not really, I said.
"Oh, Michael, if you, a historian, do not know, then what hope is there?"
"Well, it's not really my period, you see." Leo dipped his head in despair.
"Well, I tell you then, towards the end, the SS were absolutely determined that not one single Jew would be liberated by the onrush of the Allies. It was clear to them all that the war was lost, but no Jew would survive to see his freedom or tell the tale. As the Americans and British advanced from the west and the Soviets from the east, a huge army of camp prisoners was evacuated from the camps and marched into the center of Germany. The prisoners were beaten bloody, tortured, starved, murdered out of hand, forced to travel miles on no greater daily ration than a single turnip. Hundreds of thousands died. These were the Todesmärsche, the death marches. Now you know."
"Now I know," I agreed.
"So, one day, a week or so after leaving Auschwitz, my mother and I met up with a small group who had somehow managed to escape one of these marches. 3 children and 2 men. Some others had left with them but died on the way. They had come from almost the same place as us, from the camp at Birkenau, sometimes known as Auschwitz II. We struggled west across the Czechoslovakian border together in a pitiful condition, travelling only by night, leaving the road by day and sleeping in ditches and under hedges. One of the men could only hop. He had an edemic leg that began to stink of gangrene. One of the children died while walking with me, just fell down dead without a sound. After a week, we were picked up by Czechoslovakian communists. My mother and I were moved from one refugee centre to another, each bigger than the last. Finally, yielding to my mother's incessant talk of her brother-in-law in New York City, we were sent further west to be processed by the Americans. A sergeant ruffled my hair and gave me a stick of chewing gum, just like in the movies. He questioned us, noted down our tattoo numbers, and issued us with travel and identity papers. In 1946, we finally received permission to cross the Atlantic and live with our Uncle Robert and his family in the borough of Queens. So, my father's plan had worked perfectly. I grew up as an American Jew, with my American Jewish cousins, knowing nothing of my past beyond the stories I was told of my great and murdered father, the good Dr. Abel Zuckerman of Krakow. You wonder that I accepted this story, perhaps. Surely I knew that this was a lie.
"I don't know," I said. "I mean, you must have remembered some of your earlier life."
"I don't know.
Maybe I did. Maybe I raised it. I can't remember now what I remembered then, if you see what I mean. How much of your life do you remember from before you were seven? Is it not just shadows with strange patches of light? Everything my mother told me, I believed. Children do. Consider, too, the trauma of the days of starvation and walking and hiding, the bewilderment of being herded from place to place for endless months, the boredom and nausea of the ocean voyage. All these did much of my mother's work for her. It was a year and a half after my arrival in America before I was capable of any real conversation. By the time I emerged from my silence, I truly believed I was Leo Zuckerman. Nothing else would have made sense. But your uncle, how could your mother convince him she was really his sister-in-law? Robert had been parted from his brother for 10 years. He had never met the real Hannah Zuckerman. Why should he doubt her? Oh, she had an explanation for everything, my mother. She even explained. Leo paused, his face momentarily screwed up in pain and embarrassment. She even explained my penis. I'm sorry? She told Uncle Robert that the Moyle in Krakow had been rounded up by the Nazis in 1938, before my circumcision could be performed. It was done to me in New York within a week of my arrival there. That I will never forget. Circumcision, Hebrew classes, bar mitzvah, all those I remember with perfect clarity. And now, as she lay dying in front of my eyes, my mother decides to tell me that it has all been a lie. My whole life has been a lie. I am not a Jew. I am a German. Wow. Wow is as good a word as any other. Wow about covers it. I look down on this woman, this Martha Bauer from Münster. Her face is as white as the pillow behind her, and her eyes are burning with what I can only call pride. "So now you know, Axie," she says to me. "The use of the name strikes me like a rock, stirs muddy pools of memory. Axie, it rings a bell, as they say." "And my real father?" I ask her. "Sturmbannführer Bauer? What of him?" She shakes her head. "He was captured by the Poles and hanged. I found out. Eventually, I found out. It took me years. I had to be careful, you see. At last, I hit upon the idea of calling the Simone Wiesenthal Center in Vienna and claiming that I had seen him in the street in New York. They say to me that it must have been someone else, since for sure Dietrich Bauer was tried and executed in 49. Then I know. But don't worry, Axie," she adds hastily. "I'm sure he died happy, knowing that we were safe." "Why have you never told me this before, Mutti?" I ask, keeping the horror from my voice. This is a dying woman. You cannot badger the dying. "One thing mattered only, your safety. In this world it is better to be a Jew than a German. But I always wanted you to know one day what you really are. I have been a good mother to you. I protected you." Michael, I tell you, there was a kind of ferocity in her voice that terrified me. "You should not be ashamed of your father. He was a good man, a fine doctor, a kind man. He did what he could. No one understands now. The Jews were a threat, a real threat. Something had to be done. Everyone thought so, everyone. Maybe some people went too far, but the way they talk about us now, you would think we were all animals. We were not animals. We were people with families, with ideals, with feelings. I don't want you to be ashamed, Axie. I want you to be proud." This is what she said to me. I sat with her for a while, her hand grasping mine, I could feel the grip of it weaken. At last she said, "Tell the others they may come in now. I am ready." I turned from the doorway and saw that she had taken up a Hebrew prayer book. I stood staring at her as her friends filed in past me and surrounded the bed, as is the Jewish custom. And that, Michael, is the last I saw of my other parent. So, now you know. The coffee was cold in my cup. I looked at the bookcase at the row upon row of books, all on that subject. Leo followed my eyes. Primo Levi's book, The Periodic Table, is prefaced by a Yiddish saying, he said. Iberge kumene tsoris is good zu derzählen. Troubles overcome are good to tell. For him, for others, it may be that the troubles have been overcome. For me, they will never be overcome. And they have not been good to tell. There is a stain of blood upon me that can never be washed away in this world, maybe in another. So let us go, Michael, and create that other world.
Making History. 47 degrees, 13 minutes north, 10 degrees, 52 minutes east. Fade in. Exterior Michael's house, night. Establishing shot of the Newnham house. All the lights are on. An owl hoots. A thumping, scrabbling sound is heard inside. Cut to interior Michael's house, bedroom, night. Inside the house, Michael is in the bedroom, looking under the bed. He talks to himself. Michael, come on, baby. I know you're here somewhere. He moves to the wardrobe and opens it. It is empty. He searches on the floor. Michael, come on! He slaps his thigh in frustration as he stands. He checks the top of the wardrobe. Nothing. He moves to the bathroom. Cut to interior Michael's house, bathroom, night. Michael flings open the bathroom cabinet above the wash basin. He has been rather too violent. All the contents of the cabinet tumble out. Shaving cream, toothpaste, toothbrushes, tubes of ointment, bottles of pills. Michael, yelling furiously, "Ass! Pants! Double pants!" He scrabbles all the things together and tries to cram them back in. This doesn't work well. Michael, "Panty ass! Fuck!" He snatches at a razor, cutting his hand as it closes around it. Michael sucks at the blood, enraged. Michael, "Jesus in bollock pants!" He stamps through to the kitchen, muttering. Michael, "Arsy, pant, pant, bollocky, damn!" Cut to interior Michael's house, kitchen, night. Michael runs his hand under the tap and goes moodily to the central table. On the kitchen table, his wallet lies open. The contents are spread out. Some money, credit cards, driving license, scraps of paper. Michael sits moodily at the table and goes through these items. He puts his fingers in the wallet and checks each corner of each compartment. Michael, muttering to himself, "Somewhere safe. That's a joke." He puts his head in his hands and rocks backwards and forwards in misery. Michael, as Olivier in Marathon Man, "Is it safe? Is it safe?" As Hoffman in the same film, "Sure, it's safe. It's so safe you wouldn't believe." He howls at himself furiously. Michael, "You moron! You arsehole! You couldn't be trusted to keep a cold, could you? Why? Why the fuck couldn't I just..." Suddenly, he raises his head. Michael, "Hey." A smile grows. Michael, "Yeah." It becomes a beam. Michael, "Why the fuck not?" He stands up and runs to the study. Cut to interior Michael's house, study, night. Michael goes not to his half of the study, but to Jane's. There are the boxes still, neatly labelled, ready to be sent on. Michael, she won't have remembered it. She won't have remembered. She can't have remembered. He opens the bottom drawer of Jane's desk and feels towards the end. Michael, mimicking Jane. Always keep a spare. Always keep a spare. His hand finds something. Michael, yes! His hand comes out bearing a dusty credit card. Michael blows on it, close on the card. Not a credit card, but some sort of ID. There is a photo of Jane on it, looking severe. Michael kisses the card and runs his finger along its magnetic strip. Michael, bitch, sow, cow, darling, mwah! Cut to exterior genetics lab, night. Michael, in black polo neck, black trousers and black gloves, leaps somewhat unconvincingly from bush to bush outside the laboratory. He gazes at the building. The lobby is lit, but there are no other discernible lights. Michael looks at his wristwatch. Michael pants. He hops out from behind a bush and walks towards the glass doors, more or less confidently. We see behind the main door a security lock with a slit for swiping cards. Michael takes up the card, swallows twice, and slides the card through. A red light turns to green, and we hear a satisfying clunk. Michael pushes open the door and goes in. Cut to interior genetics lab lobby, night. Michael pads quietly across the lobby towards the lifts. He looks left towards a reception desk. There is no one there. Everything is eerily quiet. Michael presses an elevator button and the doors sweep open. He swallows nervously, enters the lift, and the doors close behind him. Cut to interior genetics lab, third floor, night. A silent passageway, barely lit. Ping! Light floods in as the elevator doors open and Michael emerges, looking nervously left and right. He feels his way along the corridor until he comes to a door he knows. He peers at the security lock and slides down his card once more. Another satisfying clunk. He steps into the room and turns on the lights. Michael, all right. Cut to interior genetics lab, Jane's lab, night. Light flicks on from overhead fluorescent strips as Michael steps into the centre of the room. He is on familiar ground here. He stares around for a moment, accustoming himself to the glare of the tube lighting. He moves forwards to the bench. Michael, now, where are you, my beauties? Don't say. He stares at a corner of the bench which is empty. His hand strokes the bare surface. Michael, no, no, that would be... Stay calm, kid, always calm. He stands back, trying to keep a lid on his mounting fears. He looks at the bench, as do we. Deep sinks with rubber-hosed faucets, electrical equipment, centrifuges, racks of test tubes. Below and above the benches there are cupboards, like in a fitted kitchen. Michael takes a deep breath and goes to a cupboard. He pulls it open. Close on Michael's face, we look at the cupboard. Empty. Michael, arse. He opens another cupboard. Empty. Michael, pants. And another. Empty. Michael, double arse. Another. Empty. Michael, double pants. Yet another. Full. What was that? Michael's brows shoot up. Yes, full. The cupboard is filled with large glass jars. One of them contains orange pills. We have seen these before. Scarcely able to breathe, in case this is all a mirage, Michael leans forward and takes up the glass jar of pills. He sets it down on the bench tenderly, opens it, and takes out a handful of pills. He stares at them, breathes a deep sigh, and begins to fill his pockets. Cut to interior genetics lab, ground floor lobby, night.
The lift doors open and Michael steps out. He crosses the lobby and is just about to open the door and leave when... a sound. Michael pricks his ears. We hear a strange muffled howling. Michael turns and looks down the corridor, frowning in puzzlement. Intrigued, Michael pads along the corridor. The howling sound grows. He stops outside a door. It is mostly wooden, but there is a vertical strip of glass. Michael presses his eyes to it. From Michael's POV, we look in as well. Dimly lit, we make out cages. Inside the cages, there are dogs, the cutest puppies you've ever seen, nosing softly and sadly against their steel bars. Michael, whispering, "Hey there, pups." The howling grows. The cages begin to rock. Michael, "Shh, hey guys, shush, okay?" Michael feels for his security card and swipes it through. He steps in. Cut to Interior Genetics Lab's animal testing room, night. Michael switches on the lights and surveys the room. All around him are cages filled with puppies. The whimpering, scrabbling and howling has grown to horrific proportions. Michael, nervously, "Hi there, fellas. Shush now." The sound grows even louder. "Michael, you puppies, me pup. Glad to know you." More scrabbling and howling. "Michael, listen, I can't set you free. You're too young. You'd die. Believe me, it'd be cruel. I'm sorry." Different angles on the puppies. Somehow they begin to look almost sinister, huge, malevolent. The noise swells, the cages rock. It looks as if the locks might give way. Michael backs away, scared. He leaves the room and shuts the door behind him. Cut to Exterior Genetics Lab, night. Michael runs from the building, the howling of the puppies still echoing in his ears. Cut to Exterior Maddingley Road, night. Music. Michael is bicycling along at top speed. He leans round a corner and down the drive towards the Cavendish Laboratories. He thrashes along to the car park and to the front of the building, where Leo is waiting outside, carrying a portable computer bag and looking a little impatient. Michael dismounts and lets his bicycle drop where it is. "Leo, any later and we would have missed the satellite." Michael, panting, "Sorry, I had to..." Leo, "Never mind, you're here. Let's go." Leo turns to the door of the building. Michael takes his briefcase from the rear of his fallen bike and follows. Michael, under his breath, "Jawohl, mein Hauptmann. Schnell, schnell." Cut to Interior Satellite Communications Room, night. Leo has set up the machinery. Tim is plugged in. Cables and flat cords fan out from its rear. We notice that a dimode label saying TIM has been fixed above the screen. Michael, "I lost the pill. Can you believe it? I was sure I'd put it somewhere safe, but I'd lost the sucker. Had to go and get some more. That's why I was late." Leo, concentrating on what he is doing, "You lost it?" Michael empties his pockets. There are at least 30 of the pills. Michael, "It's okay. I got all these now. Maybe it's no bad thing. I mean, would one have been enough? We don't really know anything about these suckers, do we?" Leo looks at the pills. Leo, "True." Michael, "How many do you reckon?" Leo, "We'll see. We cannot even be sure if Alois will drink." Michael, "Sure he'll drink. Think of his hangovers in the mornings. All he will want to do is drink gallons and gallons of water." Leo, "Such is our hope. Now, if you please, the coordinates." Michael opens his briefcase and consults his notes. He calls out the coordinates. Michael, 47 degrees, 13 minutes, 28 seconds north, 10 degrees, 52 minutes, 31 seconds east. Leo goes to the satellite communications desk and inputs these figures as they are called out. We see the TV monitor picture from one of the satellites change its attitude and angle on the Earth.
A caption beneath reads 47 degrees, 13 minutes, 28 seconds north, 10 degrees, 52 minutes, 31 seconds east. Leo, check. Leo goes to Tim and takes a cable which he jacks into a socket that emerges from the satellite comms desk. Leo goes to Tim and switches it on. There is a small flash of light, but no image. Leo, now, the dates. Michael, we agreed on June 1888. All right, let us say 1st June 1888. Michael, in the morning. Leo, 0600 hours. Leo presses keys on Tim. He switches a switch. There is a hum as Tim's screen comes to life. Close on the screen, as before, colours swirling chaotically. A veined thread of dark purple runs through it. Michael, is that it? Leo, that's it. Brunau am Inn, Upper Austria, 1st June 1888. Michael, wow. Leo and Michael look at each other. Leo takes four pills and goes to another part of the bench where there is a strange grey metal canister with a glass lid. He lifts the lid and places the pills inside. He takes a cable from the canister and attaches it to the rear of Tim. Michael swallows. Michael, are you sure we want to do this? Leo stares at Michael. We don't have time for a conversation. In 10 minutes, we lose the satellite. Michael, it's just that... Leo, what are you saying to me? We've discussed this over and over. It's your idea, for God's sake. Michael, I know. But suppose it goes wrong. Leo, suppose it goes wrong? Suppose it goes wrong? Michael, it has gone wrong. That is the point. He jabs a finger at the screen. Leo continued. Look! There! Look! The most evil force in world history is just 10 months away from being unleashed. Misery, pain, torture, death, despair, ruin, destruction. What else can I say? Language breaks down, and we can stop it. We close in on the screen and see the coloured lights as Leo talks. Leo continued, over. This quiet little street is about to make Pandora's box look like Barbie's jewel case, and we can do something about it. We don't have to shoot a gun or throw a knife. No bomb, no poison, no pain. Just four little pills, and the evil never happened. Michael, and you will be able to sleep at night. Leo, angry. You think that's what this is all about? My conscience? Michael, well, it is, isn't it? Leo, so before, when you believed I was Jewish, it was all right then. I could seek revenge. But now that you know I am German, the son of one of the beasts of Auschwitz, that makes a difference? It is noble to seek revenge, but not to make amends? Michael. No, it's not that. I just... Leo takes Michael's hand. Leo. Pap, listen to me. In this life, you are either a rat or a mouse. Nothing in between. But... Michael. So who wants to be a rat? Leo. You didn't let me finish. The difference is that a rat does good or evil by changing things around him, by acting. The mouse does good or evil by doing nothing, by refusing to interfere. Which do you want to be? Michael looks at the screen, at Leo's face, at the pills in Leo's hands. Michael, taking a deep breath. Hell. Leo smiles. Michael returns the smile. Michael continued, be a rat and grab that mouse. Leo picks up the computer mouse that leads from Tim
and the image on screen shifts. Leo.
There! The purple is the water. It is your well. No question.
We see the purple thread running through the picture. There is a sudden movement in the background. Michael.
Christ! What was that, do you think?
Leo.
Who knows? Maybe an animal? I am zooming further into the well.
Slowly, the picture fills with purple. Michael.
I don't believe this.
Leo takes his hand from the mouse. Leo.
You know what to do now, when I give the word.
Music begins to build. Michael goes to the canister that contains the pills. There is a red button on its side. Michael licks his lips and puts his thumb to the button. Leo, meanwhile, has his finger on a switch on Tim's keyboard. The two of them look at each other. The music builds. Close on Michael. Close on the pills in the canister. Close on Leo. Close on Leo's fingers over the switching gear. Close on Michael's thumb. Leo nods twice. And Leo,
now!
Michael's thumb presses the button. We see inside the canister the four pills appear to light up and glow with light. They start to fade as Leo's finger presses his switch. Inside the purple image on Tim's screen, the dim ghosts of four orange pills emerge and glow. The pills have disappeared from inside the canister. They have emerged in the well in Brunau. Suddenly, as Michael watches, everything in the room begins to swirl and morph. The satellite monitors, the switching gear, even Leo himself are all changing shape, all taking on swirling liquid form. As the music reaches its climax, it is clear that everything around him is being gathered into a whirlpool. Matter, light, energy. Everything is swirling into a great tornado of light and colour. The epicentre of that tornado is Tim's screen. All matter, starting with small objects, is morphed and swirled into it. Michael watches as Leo disappears in front of his eyes, sucked inside the screen as if he were no more than a leaf being swept into a drain. A huge, blinding implosion of light and colour, and now Michael too is swept from his feet and flies through the screen as if diving into an ocean of glowing mercury. Everything, the universe itself, it seems, is instantaneously sucked through Tim, which now seems to turn itself out and be sucked into itself, leaving only blackout. Book 2. Local History. Henry Hall.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Projectile City.
Ow!
Hey, I said lean your head up on the wall, not bang it violently, dummy.
Gross! Totally gross!
Oh man, that is a chuck.
Heck's sake, I got some on my shoe.
His head okay? No blood, but he's going to feel a bump in the morning.
Someone take his arm.
No way am I going anywhere near.
Why does he do this every darn time? I mean, Jesus.
Should have seen him last commencement.
We don't get a move on, we're going to miss the shuttle.
I think he's done.
Oh, hey, it speaks. Where the bloody hell am I?
It speaks. Strangely. Don't jerk around, Mikey. We gotta move.
How about we grab a Whopper? Oh!
Todd, not a good idea. Oh, Lord, he's down again.
My legs don't seem to work.
No shit, Sherlock.
What is it with you, Mikey?
I mean, heck's sake, you didn't drink any more than the rest of us.
Dimly aware, through swirling mists of alcohol, that we are passing a Burger King, a strange Burger King, and a bookshop, a strange bookshop. Never seen it before. Over the road, a college gate. Trinity? Not
Trinity, St. John's. No. Where, then? Something not right with those cars. It's not just that they swim and wobble like jellyfish. It's not just that their headlights stab my eyeballs. There's something else. I'll work it out in a minute. Meanwhile, concentrate on walking. See? It's not so hard. Try a little straighter. My God, it's so humid. Who are these people, anyway?
Who are those guys? You're the one with the ideas, Butch.
That's it. Focus on what we know. Make sure we're not totally gone. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, 1969, George Roy Hill. 4/4s are 16. The Battle of Agincourt, 1415. The capital of Corsica is Ajaccio. Q. Can you tell me Napoleon's nationality?
A. Course I can.
The sun is 93 million miles from the earth, give or take. L.P. Hartley's middle name was Poles. The past is a foreign country. They do things differently there. OK, so no brain damage. Drunk, though. Well slammed, no doubt about that. And woozy from a bang on the head. Just go with it, son. Someone's holding me up so tightly it's tugging at the skin of my underarm. Hey, what a sweet little bus. What the hell is the driver doing over there? Maybe I'll try and sleep a little.
Wake up, vodka boy. Henry Hall.
Henry Hall? Who's Henry Hall?
Just leave him here in the lobby. What do you say? Grow up, Williams.
It's okay. I'll get him to his room.
You're a hero, Steve.
Seriously, though, where am I?
Oh, boy. Just follow me, man. I'm right behind you. Night, fellas. Night, Steve.
You think he's okay? He'll be fine. I'll make sure. What is this place? Home sweet home, Mikey. Here we go. One step at a time.
Where'd the others go?
The others have gone to their beds. Now you must go to yours. Then I can go to mine, which would be good. Key, please.
Huh? Key?
Key. What key? Please don't fool around, Mikey. I really need your key.
My key? Mikey? Who's Mikey? Who's my key?
Where is it?
Key? I don't have a key.
Sure you do.
No key.
Yes, key.
Mikey, we're going to wake someone up any minute.
Hey, what are you doing?
It's nothing personal, Mikey. I just need to find...
Get your hands out of my pockets, will you? I'm telling you, I don't have...
Okay, so what's this? A lucky charm?
I've never seen that before in my life.
You are seriously weird.